Hi, welcome to LA Lit. We're here with Jose Felipe Alvergue, and I'm Matt Timmons.
I'm Stephanie Ryu. LA Lit is a podcast in which Matt and I interview writers from Los Angeles and those coming through Los Angeles. You can find us at www.la-lit.com. We are sponsored by Superbunker, which is at superbunker.com, and we're hosted by Beta Level, which is where we are today in Chinatown, and that website is betalevel.com. Welcome.
Oh, hi, thank you.
So, Jose is a writer and teacher in Los Angeles. He was born in El Salvador, and he grew up in San Ysidro on the U.S.-Mexico border. He was a student at UCSD and became involved with Taco Shop Poets and Red Calaca Press, which was just Calaca Press, I guess, at one time. And became a board member with various artists and writers and activists of Voz Alta, a not-for-profit Chicana art gallery and social collective. Jose is a graduate of the CalArts MFA writing program, and it's been published in Temper, Mag, 14 Hills, Nocturnes, and Black Clock. And he's also slated to appear in issue 5 of Trepan.
It's real, right?
Trepan? Yeah, that's real too. Yeah. Trepan is a real magazine. And I think a lot of people in LA have know Black Clock magazine, and even beyond LA. So you've kind of extended your reach outside of Los Angeles. But you're going to read from excerpts from your novel Dash American, right?
Yeah.
Is it blank?
I don't know. I mean, I came up with it 2 years ago, and I don't know what I was thinking then, and I just kind of stuck to it because, might as well. Initially, it was just supposed to be, a blank space. Okay. But then there's no way of really saying that out loud without saying blank. And that sounds like really lame, you know what I mean? So it sounds like a Wayans Brother movie. So, I mean, I don't know. I think I'm just going to go. I might just drop all of it and just say American,
No,
because that's what it was supposed to be anyways. Like saying why that's so artificial, why put a dash in front of something to demarcate? Why not just allow it to be, But instead of making some sort of weird conceptual, thing that kind of discusses that, why not just say it? So.
So the conceptual thing may be a leftover from your CalArts days.
From my CalArts days, yeah.
Well, all right. I think you're just going to jump in and read a poem that kind of visits the...
Yeah, well...
Tell us about it.
Yeah, the good thing about this novel is that it's not, it's not traditionally all prose and all narrative. It began as a really long poem, but then I found difficulties in sort of poetic language to do sort of the A to B sort of things that a novel should have, right? That a narrative should have, a story should have. But I also still found a lot of value in poetic language that it exists at different time periods within the same sentence, almost, the use of metaphor and simile, it's very referential, and you need to sort of be able to kind of jump back and forth through the material world, material history, to understand what's happening in the narrative itself. So I kept a lot of it also. So these first two selections that I'm going to read they're poems, and I think that alone they stand on their own, but I think the beauty of this novel is that since it's broken up into poems and narrative, they kind of bleed into each other, that I can kind of do something like this. And the poetic sections kind of contextualize some of the prose sections, and some of the prose sections explain some of the poetic sections. So this first poetic section kind of contextualizes a specific character whose name is Alma Gonzalez. And again, the use of poetic language, because it is referential to the real world, that you need to actually go through a cognitive process to understand what you're reading. You have to know something or kind of reach beyond, I'm reading a book now and everything's going to be explained to me sort of mentality. I use it for this character specifically because she was a real person, right? When I worked at a high school, I worked for, it was a gang risk intervention program. And one of my students, he had actually initiated a theatrical troupe of students who were recovering addicts and recovering gang members, quote unquote, at-risk students. And Alba Gonzalez was someone who was getting over, substance abuse problems. She was 17, and on her 18th birthday, she had a party. She was at a friend's house, and she was walking around at night, and she was run over by a drunk driver. I mean, the politics of the area where I grew up, it was very sort of plain. The drunk driver was white, and he was from an affluent neighborhood. He was drunk, you know, and he was trying to sort of evade checkpoints, border checkpoints that they have on the freeway. So he was kind of taking a series of boulevards that run the course of, like, the coastline, and you can get to, like, sort of these neighborhoods, you know, kind of cutting through my neighborhood, basically, you know. And he wasn't charged with anything but a DUI. And so he kind of got away. She died, and they said it was her fault because she was jaywalking. And just the politics of it, the way it was described in the newspaper, was, like, very much, oh, you know, it's just her fault. It's, like, the fault of other, you know, people like her, basically, quote unquote. So I use her all the time in this novel. She actually begins the novel, and she was the reason why I began writing it. And she kind of goes throughout the story as like as a santo, you know, she's a saint, yeah. Right? And she sort of, she weaves in and out of everybody's story. And at one point she becomes kind of like the metaphor for what this space symbolizes, you know, both as like a simultaneous existence of time and space, you know, history and sort of present time, or history and possibility, mm-hmm. the possibility of human beings who dream and want to be something, but live according to the material reality of their surroundings. So this is a poem, or, you know, it is a poem, but it's one of the sections anyway. as a child, she had gone to church with her grandmother, wore a crucifix, which with time, as she got older, became a tag with her name on it. At night, she whispered prayers with time, her desires and dreams. Rezaba con la noche, Alma González. Her body then, as a child, a church that smelled of her mother. Ashes gathered in long grooves of an aluminum wall. Alma era oración, su cuerpo la palabra. When a child, her mind, an altar. Her grandmother's head in the center, whispering light through painted glass onto holy sacrament in the body of sweetbread. Los domingos, después de misa y cuando era niña, Alma comía conchas dulces, espolvoreadas en azúcar los colores de casas rosadas y amarillas, casas colgadas de calles apretadas, casas en filas como el pan dulce detrás de una vitrina, siempre manchada de dedos, deseos, y los besos de abuelitas como alas de mariposa en algún pétalo de vidrio. En los domingos, después de misa, una concha dormía en su mano, esperando convertirse en semilla de sueño, ese sueño eruptado en aliento color pastel, regresado al mundo. Tosido de los labios de una niña que con tiempo empezará a matar las hormigas que se alimentaban de sueños dulces, olvidados en las aceras, enfrente de iglesias y casas de abuelas en cidro. As a child, Alma was a church. Under the heavy foot of cidro streets, her body became the city, her mind the sky over it. Looking down onto her body from her thoughts and dreams, she began to see herself, her hip, her arms, a breast, the arc of her knees bending. The trace of her early blood behind her thigh pulled across her body. She lay mangled in parts, covered in sugar dust, traces of old dreams and her grandmother's whispers. Waiting for beauty, she, as the sky, would let rain down. She gave meaning to these parts, a little rain on the cheekbone, dryness for the fingers. No moles now, no more moles. Come wind along the spine, down to but what about the eyes? Maybe more sun, a lighter color, dust into the hair, but the feet, a high tide. What about beauty? A street to admire it from, a building to store it in, a highway for more to come and see, houses on the hillsides, houses on the shoulders, a highway for more to come and see, highway in between those two breasts, those two small things, houses on them maybe, houses built new and so close together, the old ones down by the belly button, old houses down by the wrist of a hand left in water, wrinkled and useless. A toe in the desert cracked and crumbling, a toe lost and decaying into corpse. Let beauty rain down, Alma, let it rain with mud, let it swallow itself. Swallow the freeway, swallow the road, trampled on to come see, tripped over to come take pieces away of beauty you let rain down. Let floods come wash roadsides, trash at the sides, glass and the hundreds of white crosses, keep one or the other. Trash and God, God and trash, beauty and moles, thousands of crosses, 100,000 prayers and dreams, memory and wish. Come let rain fall, let raindrops hang in the sky. Stop to see stories crash into the desert. Stop to see speeding vans, frail bodies, tired walkers fall to earth, their bodies into the shape of cinders. Let the rain come wash blood from the roads. whispering in fields. Come flood the deserts, come spit onto cities, drops of story onto streets, onto sugar of the past and over the backs of ants, their little brittle arms cradling corpses of sweetbread. Come let the rain come down, let rain fall on Cedro, now and all its border. Come bring time down, raindrops, so that we can finally understand beauty, and finally, Alma, see your beauty the way you see from the sky, what you left behind to float high from where you see your mangled body lie. So we could, you want to talk about that section?
For yeah. Well, that was nice. First question I have, I was just thinking, I mean, I've read other sections of your novel and I've never seen this poem in this form, but I was just wondering, kind of in the process of writing the book, when, you know, when did this poem come, or was the character more developed before you hit upon this section?
Yeah, this part comes like much later in the novel. It was, you know, it's kind of towards the end, so yeah, I don't think he saw it. And I think a lot of, I mean, this was like my first novel, you know. It was really sort of an experiment on how do you write a novel. Do you just like write a bunch of pages? It doesn't make sense. I don't know. And I think for a long time, you kind of form a real relationship with like the characters, because you don't know how much of them are real on their own, you know, and how much control like you have over them. And then you become really sort of paranoid. It's like, oh, am I like making them do too much stuff? Should they have told me what they want to do by now? You know what I mean? And so this particular section, it did come out like at a moment of frustration of saying, well, I mean, why do I keep using this girl who's like a real girl, you know, and she has like a real family? And like, I mean, how the hell do I tell, you know, how do I explain, oh, I'm writing a novel about your daughter? It's like, fuck you, like, it's my daughter. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a character. So, I mean, I think at this point it was really sort of me sort of dialoguing with myself. It's like, well, what is she to me then? You know? And I think because she does represent a lot of the politics of that space, I think it was just finally like something that I wrote that made me sort of feel comfortable kind of continuing to use her in the work, mm-hmm. you know? So yeah, it is kind of like a culmination point where it's like, I finally state, you know, what her relationship is to the rest of the book. She's just not sort of this like object that floats in and out of different narrative scenes, but she is, you know, she is that space, you know, I mean, she is the politics of that space. She is sort of the reason of that space. She is the reason of why I'm writing about that space. You know, she represents all of that. And I think it was finally when I said, you know, it's okay to use her, even though she was a real person, because that's what real people are for. You know what I mean? You know, I mean, because there's also an allusion to sort of people who die in the desert here. Yeah. Like border crossers who are dying in the desert. Yeah. And I also, I mean, I use them a lot too in the book, and I started to feel bad about that. But it's like, no one else is ever going to remember them. Sure. You know what I mean? And that's like the point. That's why they let them die. And that's the point of why they're in the news, is because we know that when they're in the news, we're going to be with them only for that period of time. And they're gone.
And then we can forget.
Yeah, and then something else comes. And that's kind of our own pathology of how we forget things that we do.
Sure.
You know, we make a big deal about it in a certain way, in a certain context, and then it's gone. And so then I think there's a definite tie between her and sort of the allusion to the people who are dying in the desert, the allusion to sort of the landscape itself and how it's changing, you know, the development, the houses, and the freeways and all this, right? We're building over, like, these lands, you know?
Well, talk about the town that you set this in, Cedro.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I think that ties to what you're saying
right now. I mean, yeah, the real name is, oh, Stephanie, you want to go?
Well, yeah, just, and also how you're talking about memory and forgetting, and how the way you talk about the cities and your pieces, how much the memory of what was there before permeates everything that's there now, and how everything's drifting and changing. And
yeah, no, definitely. You know, back when I still lived there, it was like 2002, I guess. And the real name is San Isidro. I use Isidro just because it's easier for me as a writer to kind of fictionalize space if you change the name.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
But it's like San Isidro, and like, you know, I lived there in 1986 to 2002. Like, my parents still live there, you know, a lot of my friends still live there.
Yeah.
And it's gone through a lot of developmental changes. I think initially, I mean, back, like, you know, in the early American days, it was just like this marsh town. It was literally all a marsh, and they wouldn't want to build anything on it. But it served a very specific purpose of trade, even back then. You know, it was like a post. You know, it was like the last sort of stop before things became international trade, even back like in 1896 or whatever the hell. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that sort of mentality sort of remained with it. And it was used, you know, like in the early 90s with the birth of global trade, it was a very specifically used space. You know, it was like this section serves only for the transfer of goods, the transfer of sort of ciphers, really, the transfer of sort of electronic profit. You know, either you're a tourist coming through, you're a truck driving product across, you're a border crosser bringing labor north but sending money south, yeah. You know? It wasn't meant to be sort of a city in the sense that, you know, people live there. And so I think a lot of the times it's treated that way. And it's very obvious because out of all the other border cities in the United States, it's the only one that's connected to like another large metropolitan area, San Diego. Mm-hmm. So it's very sort of evident where the demarcations are. You know, like in border towns in Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, like it's that town and then a lot of land and then something else. So it was, you can't, you know, the space is that space and it defines itself and it's sort of, they're allowed to live their own identities. But in San Ysidro, it's very obvious that they're treated differently and that the space is treated differently and it's considered different, you yeah. know? And it's very upsetting if you grow up in that and, you know, and you can recognize it because, you know. So I think, you know, that's...
Well, it's yeah, I mean, it sounds like, you know, your relationship with it because you grew up there is, it's a state, that's where you were.
Yeah.
It's a stationary place, but you were constantly seeing things drift.
Yeah, and it really changed, you know, when I started going to college at UCSD, but I was still living in San Ysidro, so I was, like, driving to La Jolla and, like, driving back down. It's like, you're not stupid, you're not blind, you know. And then especially as a graduate student, then you get interested in sort of larger sort of intellectual pursuits, and you begin to, like, look at it in a different way, and it becomes, that also becomes, like, a pathos, you know.
Yeah.
Because you begin to sort of discuss your own personal experiences in a very sort of detached intellectual way, and that becomes, you know, it kind of hurts a little, you know. So I think in this book specifically, I think it was a weird process because it was all about pathos for me, you know.
Also, you contrast the city with Tijuana.
Yeah.
And it makes me think of the continuousness of San Diego into Tijuana, and yet how different they are.
Right.
And then also in your pieces, how people are moving north.
Yeah.
One by one.
Yeah, Tijuana also plays a central role because it's a destination point for a lot of investment and a lot of profit. It's like a beginning and end point. You know, all the maquilas are there. Like, that's where the factories are. That's where the raw material goes. That's where the labor begins. But it also, on a larger sort of global scale, it's also where a lot of labor sort of crosses through on their way north, you know. But the city itself, its infrastructure is, like, designed around sort of receiving investment to, like, a central sort of place. And this defines that infrastructure, and the city becomes built around a purpose, you know. That becomes, like, the purpose of it. And people who live there, they live according to that economic purpose. So they have purpose, right? They can apply sort of, like, their own possibility and their own sort of histories and past to, like, some sort of, you know, present and then some sort of desired future for their sort of little city. But in San Ysidro, it's much different because there's no such space defined,
right?
It's supposed to be sort of like a space that just serves for ports of entry, really. You know, there's like two freeways that go into TJ, and then, you know, there's land. Oh, people live there? Oh, I didn't know that. Jeez, you know, that's interesting. But it's really obvious, it's really strange because now, I would say, like, in the late 90s to the present time, there's been a lot of development there. You know, it's actually become kind of like a large, like, suburb. And it's really weird. And then there's been, like, a lot of investment in terms of bringing in, what are they called? Like, these duty-free stores and, like, where are the stores where they sell stuff for cheap? It was, like, one leg is longer than the other. Outlets? Outlets, yeah. So they now have all these outlets, you know, and they build, like, these huge commercial centers, and people go there to, like, shop at these commercial centers. And it's really odd, and it kind of coincided with the advancement of technology and surveillance. Uh-huh. You know, once, like, surveillance became something that didn't have to be so physically present all the time. You didn't need, like, five, you know, immigration Broncos parked on your street because you have all these radars and there's a plane in the air that's, like, shooting stuff down. And they divided everything into, like, these grids that you don't even see. So, like, the lack of sort of physical presence of surveillance, like, it really allowed the space to be used for something else.
Huh.
But all that investment in sort of increasing the technology meant that, oh, we should really protect something that's real now. You know what I mean? So then they brought in all this commercial investment, which really makes, like, the space like an American suburb. And so it's really strange to go back there now for me because I have this picture in my mind, and I go back, and it's like, where am I? This kind of feels like Valencia, you know?
Valencia.
But the people I see are like people that I know, you know what I mean? Yeah. And in a lot of ways, I think it's even more of an interesting space now, because it's like the devices that they've used to sort of define it has sort of backfired on like these machines of surveillance.
Huh.
You know, now that we have all this access to purchase the same things, quote unquote, other Americans do, it's like, you know, it's like, well, we can buy a product and understand the value on multiple levels. Like, I can buy like a shirt there and understand that it's made probably like, you know, by an 11-year-old Indonesian girl. But that's cool because like I come from like a culture who's like, my purpose was to also work in these factories. You know what I mean? But I can buy it now and I have access to it. And I can value this like sort of object like on more levels that you can, you know, yeah. American guy. You know what I mean? So like now it's like, but see, this is what America is. This is like how we evolve. We begin,
sure.
The language remains the same, but we learn to value things on different levels. We understand the, you know, like the values of objects.
And it's like the ciphers that you were talking about passing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the other piece. This is what you're talking about, like Tijuana being a place where people cross to other places. I think this next one is about Carlos and Elizabeth from the novel. Okay.
So then this is about sort of some of the sacrament. This is about migration in a lot of sense. And these are two, some of the central characters. I'm just going to read it, whatever. They were called aliens, Carlos and Elizabeth, who met in Ciudad Juarez in Mexico, lying on cool grass in a park, a large bush between them, a trash can painted like a strawberry wafer when wind came and blew a gust of sand onto Carlos, dreaming of the taste of mangoes verdes in El Salvador, the grass soft and reviving, grass like salt over mangoes verdes, peeled and ready to eat in September. Mierda, yelled Carlos when sand went up his nose and scratched his eyelids, just as a girl in Elizabeth's dream had her veil raised at the altar to reveal an ugly fat man. They jumped to their feet and saw each other over the border of leaves and garbage between them. The smell of the trash can had burned the bush yellow. Carlos had sand on his mustache and on his eyebrows. His shirt was wrinkled, tucked into his slacks. She laughed at him. He was skinny and pathetic. Chile powder had landed on her cheek from a cup hanging to the edge of the trash can. Two strands of curly long hair hung down the sides of her face. He laughed back at her. She was beautiful and had no one to share it with. ¿De dónde vienes? ¿Para dónde vas? Practiquemos el inglés. Hello, how are you, sir? No te rías. Carlos wanted to buy her his story, wrapped in greasy newspaper from the man pushing a cart through the park. Carlos wanted to hand it to her with both hands and watch her take it, lift it as if it were a baby's foot to her lips, and smell and taste it at once. I come from, well, and I live on the beach. Que no te rías, a ver, tu turno. In English, please. But all that came from his face was a smile of an idiot, of every man when he feels he's been played a trick on before the whole world. There were only papers in his pockets, lists of names, fake file numbers, pale green papers whose ink smeared, little square papers covered with stamps and mosaic patterns of blue and red and black, like the big continents on maps. He only had phone numbers with no phones to ring for them, hand-drawn maps of the desert. Elizabeth watched his eyes and knew that they were both aliens in Ciudad Juarez. Ciudad Juarez is a city of streets. Buildings and houses are made important in how they want to be a part of what's happening on them, feel the exhaust of large red buses on their faces to prove they are in Juarez, that they feed off the blood that flows through the streets like veins and connect the city with a taste of tar. Carlos and Elizabeth dreamed on these streets, relaxed to the ticking of iron stoves, cooling off under the heavy gaze of lavender evening skies, feeling the stretching of their skin the way streets spread themselves out. Juarez had a rhythm. It breathed. And no matter where Carlos and Elizabeth hid, there was a window. And outside these windows, the street staring back at them, whispering a song of the city, a relentless hum, a note held to its bone. They walked through the city, the streets and their winding, their incessant directions, and then the way light played through corridors created by the eager faces of buildings leading them directly out into fields of nothing, waiting like hungry mouths to devour them. Young men, old men, women, children, lunatics who spoke to the wind, living in some other world that ended in the hands of Border Patrol agents, inevitably crumbled between their leather gloves, always. Always the river to the north, the mountains to the south, looking bruised in the evenings when the light was low, and the only place for the moon was the sand and its own glimmering reflection in the river lapping up against the long hip of the city where dreamers all waited together before La Cruzada. What a city, sitting on its patch of dirt at the edge of El Rio, as if it were designed by forever to be on its own, and forever must have intended the people of Juarez to go on and age with it, locked in by the mountains, a desert, and a river. What a city. What people that pass through it and change it all with something as easy as walking. What forever does at the border of a dream made crazy by the hissing of a river's current and the endless purple shadow of desert and mountain. Carlos and Elizabeth married the day before leaving north. Old women massaging fat bellies of beads like cockroaches and whispering prayers like chewing the skin of corn were their witnesses. A boy sweeping the entrance turned once, thinking about the girl who sold flowers with her mother on Wednesdays and continued sweeping. The church door was his witness. Te daré una casa, una familia, una ciudad con nombre y un país. Carlos promised Elizabeth only what he thought was real, only what was offered. And Carlos and Elizabeth laughed when Mexico was only a distant finger of lights lying on its underside. They were called aliens, Carlos and Elizabeth, who left echoes of America and the cobbles leading to nothing, blown back to the city by desert wind to be swept from church steps by a boy with a broom somewhere in Juarez, hoping to be seen by a girl and her flowers.
Jose, what about your coming north from after UCSD and going to a place like Valencia to go to CalArts to write a novel like this?
It was weird. What do you mean?
Seems weird.
Yeah, it was really weird. It was really strange. But I think my experiences, my family and I first came to the U.S., we lived like in, you know, pretty strange. We lived in Hemet. We lived in Nogales. We lived in Utah, you know. And then we moved to San Diego. But I think when I went up to Valencia, I lived in Canyon Country, which to me felt pretty good. I don't know. It was like a desert, you know. It was like there's something about desert that's just really, I don't know, it really sort of, it does something to me because you don't know where it begins and ends when you're in the middle of it, but you can still sort of, if you're aware, find markers in it. You know, you can find markers and you can understand its geography.
Were you up Soledad Canyon?
Yeah, I mean, I would just go out. I mean, like a mile from where I lived, I would be like in the middle of nowhere. I was like, oh shit, I'm kind of lost now. But it does something to your concept of space. I think desert does, you know, because you still understand it as a material composite of like smaller materials, but when you take it as a whole, it comes back to you as a whole. You know, the information you get back through your senses is one of unity. You know, and I think a lot of times we're always on quests of unity. And I think for immigrants, this isn't especially sort of, purposeful sort of task. And, you know, I mentioned this line in here, the echoes of America, and I think that we always forget that the term America has been used and is continued to use by sort of academics in other countries to refer to all the continents here. You know, it's like, it begins from, you know, I don't know, the tip of South America to, you know, to the Alaska or whatever. Right? Yeah. I mean, those are the Americas.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think it's only in this country that we try to make a difference of it. And it's very sort of, you know, it creates a neuroses, I think, when you've learned to take in space as a whole, yet as a composite. Yeah. You interact on composite levels, but you still understand it all as a whole space. I don't know. What was the question?
Well, I was going to ask you, and maybe this goes along with the way you're talking about the desert, but also in both those pieces, you're dealing with time in a certain
right.
kind of way that is similar in that it's like you take little moments of time, but then they seem to stretch out to more of a more wider sense. I mean, and you do this in your book a lot. You jump, just like you say, Alma takes jumps through the narrative world or something like
right.
that. I mean, she's kind of a central character in that she jumps around the book and tells different people's stories. But, I mean, you use her and also just the way you tell the stories,
mm-hmm.
you seem to jump from little moments in time. And a lot of time as a reader, you can't exactly tell, like, if you're going in chronological
Good.
Order.
Good.
Yeah.
No, I was joking. I don't know.
But,
yeah, no, I'm just
but,
saying.
But you get a wider, it's like,
Suffer.
Through that, you get That's a wider
right.
sense of time.
Right.
So it's like.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, you know, when I've always considered writing to be in, like, and this kind of goes to like my own personal philosophies on what writing is and like what sort of living is, but as a problem solving sort of practice, you know. And I don't mean problem solving in the sense that problem A, solve it with theorem A. You know what I mean? It's like problem solving in the sense that you're always, you're currently dialoguing with something that, you know, maybe remains unknown. You know, you're dialoguing between something that you know and then something that's beyond this limit that you've come up to, you know, and the possibility of, like, human possibility is like, what exists beyond this limit? You know, what is this limit situation? What is my act on this limit that will take me beyond it? And then what is that possibility? You know, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, people, I think we misunderstand it as being, oh, you're like an idealist. It's like, no, I think we live according to problem solving. You know, we don't, or what's the point of living? We might as well just live, you know, let our parents live for us, or like whoever was before us live for us, because, you know, the whole point is that we go beyond sort of what their limits were, and then we keep kind of going in these limits. And I think that's what sort of drives this migrations, you know. Mm. It's like these limit situations. And the whole writing, in terms of time and space, what I was trying to do, because that was what I was so engrossed with at the time, was that I wanted to create a narrative that it existed in this, like, I don't know how you say it, like simultaneity almost, you know, that time and sort of space were existing on in a sort of simultaneous way, that that they had like the similar characteristics, that you could sort of freeze time or like freeze space in a sense and kind of divide it into like these like slices, you know, and then each slice was like a material thing that you had to like sort of, like, I don't know, it's more if I chalkboard, I could draw it, and it's... And then this is what language becomes then, you know, and it's what the narrative becomes then. So then a sentence, yeah, you're right, it does kind of, you know, begin at one spot, but then it'll just go everywhere in terms of time. Mm-hmm. But because all those things are existing at the same, within the same object, you know, yeah, what I mean? Sure. Within like a beer can, there's like multiple times that are, there's multiple economies that are existing. And if we don't understand how that object came to this table here, then we're not really valorizing that object as like a historical object. We're not like valorizing as like an aspect of a material history that's gonna, you know, last even when we're gone, you know. And so then this kind of was something that I was like really sort of, you know, high on, and I was like all about that. And, you know, I mean, and I think in a lot of ways, it's also a reason why I think the book ultimately fails, you know, because that's all that I was so obsessed with, and I couldn't see anything else. And I think it does fail in a lot of ways as a unified object, because it's, you know, I don't know. It's kind of like, why would you do that to characters? You know, why would you force them into that sort of construct? It's, in a sense, I guess what I'm saying is that it was, for me, being like, when I'm going back, it was like a first novel. It was like an experiment for myself as a writer.
Sure.
It is just that. It's like, oh, I'm going to try this for a while because I'm really up on that. And then when you're done, like 350-something pages later, you look back, it's like, damn, I don't think I should have done that. You know what I mean? I should have mixed it up, man. Like, but you can't go back at that point.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It still exists, and you're like, well, I mean, I guess I could rewrite it. It's like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Like, that's who they are. That's what that book is. Oh well.
So then you move on, and
then you move on, right? Stuff. And this is what I'm saying. Writing is a problem-solving thing. It's not. I'm not out there to produce like a commercial object. I'm not out there to even produce objects. I think I'm there to sort of, you know, it's what I do to understand myself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then, but I mean, at the same time, you also want to be like, you know, validated as like what you did. Like, no one like spends years and years of, you know, like engineering school and like say, you know, I just experiment on myself. It's like, no, you want to be an engineer. You know what I mean? And so, I mean, I don't know. I'm like in a really weird spot right now that I'm done with it. And like, I can find like all these things that I did in it that I still kind of think are pretty cool. And like, I know why I did them, but because I know that I did them under the philosophy that it was all like this problem-solving thing that I don't, you know, it's...
So then where do you think that philosophy fails? You say it's a failure because you were just sticking to... Because
no one's going to read that. No one's going to... I think we're so like in this like, I don't know.
Why do you think no one's going to read it? I mean, it's...
Will you read it, Stephanie?
Yeah, right. I'd read it.
No, because what I'm saying, I mean, I think that we're all... That's not the type of world we live in, you know? We live in a world where we expect things to happen all the time.
But that's
we're
like,
constantly looking at our, you know, online phones, like, say, oh, it's the news, what's the score, what's this, what's going on? We're always waiting for something to happen.
Yeah.
And I think that when you play with time and space in the way that I did, nothing happens. You know, it becomes static. And that's exactly what I didn't want to happen, and that's what happened. You know, like, you want to show that everything is simultaneous, but you can't do that on a piece of paper. It just becomes static.
Huh.
Because the way that you read it, the way that we've learned to read, we don't go the same, go through the same cognitive sort of sacrifices to, you know, to do that. We want to see something happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about what you're just saying is the way that your book works is that constantly there are lots of things happening, actually.
Yeah, little things, but, like, nothing actually happens.
Yeah, little things. There's lots. It's like you get obsessed with, like, you know, sand blowing in someone's face.
Right.
Or, you know, a bead of sweat hanging from somebody's chin.
Oh, I should have talked about that, huh?
Yeah.
The entire story takes place inside of a bead of sweat hanging from somebody's chin.
Yeah, right.
Should have mentioned that. That was a big one.
But then, Jose, I mean, I think there's too much resolution, right? I mean, all of narrative and all of cinema up to this point is like resolve it. And yeah. Make a big boom.
No, I know. And I mean, it's like my frustrations also.
People are trained on that, and maybe now it's a good time to get weaned off it.
It is. Yeah, I know. I'm there with you. You know what I mean? But I mean, like, that's not going to happen. Like, we're watching the news to see if a plane's going to fly into something, or, like, someone's going to get, like, their head cut off. Or we're watching reality TV. Are they going to swear? Is someone going to take their shirt off? Like, what's going to happen? Do I need to take my pants off to watch? You know what I mean? It's like, we're always waiting for something to happen.
Yeah.
Everywhere we go, it's like, oh, I'm going to wear this. I'm wearing my lucky underwear. Because I might need to show it. You know what I mean? We live in a society where we're always expecting things to happen.
Yeah.
And the point is, nothing's going to happen unless we make... You know what I mean? It's like, that's not...
Unless you... Yeah.
We live up to limitations, and then we expect those limitations to be broke, but we don't actually do anything to break them.
But maybe the sense of unity is what happens.
Yeah, I mean, what do you mean?
Well, like, that's precisely it, that how you said, and I'm glad you said it when you said that the idea of the senses is to unify.
Right.
And so when you read this or you experience life even, if that's what's happening, then that's something that's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I'm okay with it, you know, I'm fine personally, but, you know, I know it's not going to go anywhere because I can't expect people to have the same philosophy that I do. And I know that no one, you know, in mass, like, we all don't.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, I think let's take a break and then come back and talk some more about this stuff. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks.